We open the scriptures together. One of the conversations that our small group was having a month or so ago before Advent started was how do we resist the cultural temptations to let our world, our culture, define our Christmas celebration for us? And one of the conversations we had was that the church's history, the church's tradition, has a pretty good tool to help us stay oriented in the season of Advent as a season of preparation and of longing and of prayer. And then the season of Christmas, which begins on Christmas Day and continues for 12 days. And so one of the things we talked about was what would it look like to really sort of celebrate Christmas this year and live in the waiting and patience of Advent. And so you can see this, it's not Christmas Day, but it's still the Christmas season, so we still have our Christmas stuff up, and I'm wearing my Christmas jacket. Thanks, Penny. I'm actually convinced Penny has been plotting for years to figure out how to get me to dress up in church, and this was her answer. Just make him look like a fool. Muhaha. How many of you listen at some point during your day, your week, your month, during the year to some form of talk radio, like news or sports talk or political pundits or preachers on the radio or podcasts? Anybody listen on the radio to some form of talking? Quite a few people. So I've been listening to the radio for years. And yet, I always do the exact same thing. I come across a photo of somebody that I've been listening to on the radio, and I'm not kidding, every single time I think to myself, he doesn't look anything like what I thought he looked like. Every time. Have you ever had this experience? I can't really explain what it is about hearing a voice that makes me automatically imagine what that person looks like. I don't know why I keep doing it, since I have like a 0% success rate. But it's really interesting to think about as you consider life and just all of the relationships that we have with different people. As you think about, like, what do we need to learn about a person and to really know them? You know, like, what does it take to truly know a person? It's interesting to consider the two men who are walking with Jesus to Emmaus, the story that we heard Jeannie read for us, right? When they finally see Jesus and they realize that he is the one that they had heard about and that they had been waiting for their whole lives, they're both shocked and have that same sort of, the Messiah wasn't anything like we were looking for. It's kind of fun to think about what would happen. Or I should say it this way. It's fun to think about the role that our five senses play in getting to know another person. The way that all of our senses work together to help us know someone. And so imagine real quick, you have five people, and each person is only allowed to use one of their senses to tell you what this sixth person is like. And so one of the five would be limited to only hearing the sixth. And so the hearer follows the sixth person around and listens to all of their conversations, noticing the noises they make when they're alone, hearing how they speak in different settings. You think about it, like, if you were just able to listen, you'd have a lot to go on. It makes you sort of wonder, what if somebody had access to everything I said out loud over a week or a month? What could they know about the kind of person that I am just by listening to the things that I say and talk about? Now, clearly the hearer couldn't possibly come close to knowing everything about you or about the sixth person, since there are a million things that we think every day but never say out loud. What if then one of the observers was limited to only their sense of taste? How would you get to know somebody using your sense of taste? Sounds a little bit weird, right? Like we're talking about somebody who goes around licking people. But it might be less weird than you think. The taster doesn't have to become a cannibal for this to work. But what if the taster ate every meal with the sixth person? You could learn quite a bit about someone just by eating whatever they eat, whenever they eat. You wouldn't learn everything by any means, but you would learn something that you couldn't necessarily learn a different way. Consider the sense of touch. Think about what a hug can teach you about a person. You could record the observations from each of these senses, drawn together with all of the senses, and you could begin to build a pretty elaborate sketch of a person. Now, obviously, if you used only a single sense, your understanding of that person would be pretty limited, right? It's like listening to someone on talk radio. Your access to who they are, you have quite a bit, but it's actually still pretty limited. But then each additional sense that you add, it gives you this fuller, more honest picture of what that person is. Put all of it together, though. All of the words they've spoken, all of the things that you've seen them do, their hugs and their food, and you still have one important step to take in knowing someone. You don't know them until you've interpreted the information that you've gathered. Just because you see someone steal a loaf of bread doesn't mean you know that person. Were they trying to feed a hungry family? Did they steal it on purpose? Did they intend to pay the person back? All of these questions show you that you have to make sense of the information as a whole. Like you have to process it and understand how it all works together to really know who this person is. Or if someone says one thing, but you see them do another, you have to decide what that means. Is that person a liar? Are they pretending to be something that they're not? Can they even recognize the gap? Maybe they don't even realize that there's a gap between what they do and what they say. Maybe the person isn't a liar at all. Maybe the person is an addict. And so they truly want to stop acting out, but can't. Or again, maybe you're looking at too small of a sample. Maybe the person almost always does exactly what she says, but it's just this one time. And so is there something you can learn about this person who does this strange thing this one time? If all of this sounds a little complex and even a bit tedious, welcome to relationships. And we almost never consciously think about what we're doing. When we interpret data about a person and make some determination about who we think this person is, but it's happening all the time, in all of our interactions, in all of our relationships. And here's why this is important. If we say that we want a relationship with God, then we need to recognize that this is the same way that we get to know God, that we interact with Him. God speaks words and we hear what He says. God gives us bread and says, taste and see that the Lord is good. And so we taste the goodness of His daily provision. God puts on flesh and He lives in front of us and we see what He does. In flesh, God touches a man's eyes. A woman touches his garment. God's life-giving touch is felt. We experience and encounter God the way we encounter and experience people. We come to know God the same way that we come to know people. So we gather information, observing and noticing and interacting. And with all of this information, we start to make sense of it. We start to interpret and make decisions about what it all means. In some way, we begin to say, based on what I have heard and seen and tasted and touched, this is who God is. This is what God is like. This is what God is doing. Built into the structure and the rhythm of Scripture is this constant invitation for us. It's an invitation by God to come and to know Him and to live in this growing relationship with Him. And yet, if you've spent any time in Scripture, if you've spent any time walking with Jesus, you know people have generally found knowing God to be maybe one of the most difficult experiences in all of life. Not because He can't be known, but because if God interacts with us in relational ways, and relationships with human beings are hard, then it takes some work to get to know God. And something happens to us sometimes coming to God. Have you ever noticed that your first impression of a person can sometimes make it really hard for you to draw near to that person? Your first impression of that person makes it really hard for you to want to have any relationship with that person. You've already decided who they are, and they're not really a person that you associate with. Right? You already have made some decisions, and so there's some distance there. And I want to suggest to you that we often start with first impressions about God that may not have actually come from God, but they're ideas that somebody has given us, ideas about God that we hold. And so we hear the invitation to come and to know God, and we resist. We decide not to know God anymore, maybe up front, because in our minds, God is scary. He is unpredictable. He becomes someone we don't think that we can trust. And so we maintain a break in relationship with God. I want to show you a little bit of what this looks like. And so if you'd open your Bibles to the book of Isaiah. So Isaiah is pretty near the middle, but then to the right a ways. So you can open to the very beginning of it. The book of Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Isaiah starts out this book by calling on everything in creation. Did you hear it? Everything in heaven, everything on earth. Listen, listen, hear what God has said. Do we have ears to hear? Isaiah continues with God's own words. Children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. God's message is pretty clear. He's describing His relationship with humanity. God sees Himself as a parent, and He talks about His care in raising and rearing and bringing up His children. And He also tells about a situation that is pretty real for many people, pretty raw for many who have adult children, that there's this division in the relationship. God's children, those who He has raised, have rebelled against Him. And God goes on, the ox knows its owner and the donkey its master's crib, anybody up on their ox and donkey background. God is setting up a comparison built on fairly common knowledge for a farming community, that everyone would have known this connection that God is making between the animal and its owner. If an animal knows his master, the question that's being set up is, how much more does a child know their parent? How much more should God's people know him? And yet we keep reading, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Israel does not know. They do not understand. Isaiah is the first of what are called the latter prophets. Latter is in later, not like climbing a ladder. And let me sort of describe where Isaiah fits into the whole of the Bible. So in the First Testament, we've got three major divisions: the law, the prophets, and the writings. Now, the Hebrew word for law also means instruction. And most people believe that this is really the best way to talk about these books because they're just general instruction. But the law is, if you look at it fairly broadly, two things: a set of stories and a set of instructions designed to help people know their God, to know the God of Israel and to follow him. And so if you think about the law, you've got stories, and you could immediately, if you've been in church for any period of time, start to recognize some of the stories. Stories about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses. But there are also then the Ten Commandments and many of the specific instructions. And so you've got narrative story and you've got specific instruction. As we've explored scripture together, we've seen how it went for Israel with this instruction from God. Right? Even with their stories about God choosing them and guiding them, for the most part, they really struggle to follow the instructions that God has given them, to draw near to God, to trust him, to know him, to follow him. So then, if the law is about God choosing Israel and instructing them, the prophets are about God remaining faithful to Israel, about God continuing to show Israel his love and God instructing his people on how they can return to him. It's interesting that the prophets have the same general content as the law: narrative stories and the instructions. And we see this breakdown in the prophets' own structure. The prophets are divided into two even sections: the former prophets and the latter prophets. And the former prophets we looked at a couple years ago are the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And they're stories. And these stories show us how God remains faithful to the people who have rebelled against him and resisted him as their father. So if these are all the stories about God's faithfulness to these people, then the latter prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and the book of the 12, tell us explicitly what Israel is doing and how they can stop doing that, how they can return to this God who has been faithful to them. The former prophets are in the narratives. The latter prophets are the instructions. These go together. It may be worth pointing out, I don't know if you've noticed this before, but this is the structure of the New Testament, starting out with the Gospels, that's the narratives of Jesus, and then followed by the letters filled with the instructions on how to follow this Jesus. Anyway, when you read the stories in the former prophets, stories in Judges and Joshua and Samuel and Kings, you sort of notice that you get caught up in the story. And sometimes it's hard to notice some of the big themes, the big things that are happening. Like one of the things that you can note, you can miss because it's not there, is the complete absence of the law from Israel's life. They don't read it, they don't reference it, they don't live by it. And it's really only at the very end of the story when one of the last kings discovers the book of the law and brings it out and tries to get Israel to come back to God and read it and follow it, that all of a sudden you realize, oh yeah, this has been missing from the whole story. This is a big issue. But the prophets, the former prophets in this storytelling way, they lead you there to this final conclusion, take you on this story that helps you see and sort of experience what life without God's instructions is like. And when you read Joshua and Judges and Samuel and Kings, you see how terrible things can get. But the latter prophets, they don't waste any time telling stories. They call a spade a spade. Prophet Isaiah announces in his very first words from God, Israel lacks knowledge. Israel has ignored the law. This is why things have gone so terribly for Israel. Right at the beginning, we get the truth. We are going to spend 2018, this year, in the latter prophets. And for the first 5 months of the year, we're going to look at the book of the 12. These are the 12 shorter books at the very end of the First Testament, starting with Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those 12 are gonna be where we're gonna sort of live for the next few months. And I want to encourage you with them. These books, along with Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, are intended to help God's people know their God and return to Him. One of the challenging things about their message is that the people that they're speaking to don't often realize that they don't know their God. Because they speak their God's name, they go to worship their God, they actually follow some of the rules that they think that they're supposed to follow. But the prophets show up to tell them they don't actually know their God. Flip with me to the book of Hosea. Go right through Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea. One of the things about these 12 is that you flip too far and you miss them because they're so small. But Hosea is the first of the 12 of these smaller prophets. They weren't shorter. They're just, their books are not as long. I want to introduce how Hosea picks up the same theme as Isaiah. So Hosea chapter 4. We heard Ali read this for us earlier. Hosea chapter 4. Since this is just our intro to the prophets, we're jumping around a little bit, but in future weeks, we'll be a bit more in single passages. But here's what we hear. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel. For the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love, and no knowledge of God in the land. God goes on to talk about all of the sin that is running wild in the land. The people are speaking falsely about God. They're lying. They're killing each other. They're stealing from one another. They're cheating on their spouses. And he sums it all up this way. The very next line, verse 2, they break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed. They break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed. In other words, all of their sin can be summed up in two general categories. No one is faithful to anything, and there is no love to be found. No one is faithful to anything. People break the bounds of truth. They break their promises. They break their commitments and marriages and social contracts and everything that they're supposed to be faithful to. And there is no love. People hurt everything and everyone that they should be loving. And God's explanation for this is just really straightforward. He says, the reason for all of this is there is no knowledge of the Lord in the land. Of course there's not. To know God is to know two things: that God is ridiculously and recklessly faithful, and two, that God is endlessly and patiently loving. God is ridiculously and recklessly faithful, and God is endlessly and patiently loving. To know God is to know these things. If Israel was familiar with the law, they would know this, but they don't know it. They don't know their God. They don't know faithfulness, nor do they know love. Instead, they worship other gods, the gods of their neighbors. And one of the things we discover throughout the First Testament is that it's often this worship of their neighbor's gods that gives them their first impression of their own God. They grow up knowing the gods of their neighbors, and so they assume that their God must also be like this. And this creates distance and is one of the reasons we discover again and again that people have a hard time drawing near to the God of Israel. They worship the gods of their neighbors. And what this means, when we look at who these gods were, they were gods who never kept their promises. They were gods who were fickle, and they did whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, because they could. And these gods that they worshiped violently destroyed the life that God lovingly made. And there's this old saying that goes, we are what we worship. And so it shouldn't surprise us that God's children break all bounds and commit bloodshed following bloodshed when they worship gods who do the same thing. And look at verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. I reject you from being a priest to me. God tells his people a simple truth. There are consequences for refusing to know God. And the first consequence is sort of a duh, right? We destroy ourselves and others when we refuse to know the God who is faithful and loving. We can't help but break our promises and hurt each other when we reject the God who keeps promises and loves. Which is to say that anyone who is faithful and does love has somehow come into some contact with God and his grace, even if they don't realize it. I think of this non-Christian couple that stayed married for 60 years. Like, whether they realize it or not, and not just married, but like a good marriage, like whether they realize it or not, they are living out the character of God in their faithfulness to one another. At some point, or at many points in their lives, they have seen faithfulness. Maybe they've seen it in a Christian couple that they've known. Maybe they've seen it somewhere, and they wanted it. They were drawn to it. And just because they didn't realize that it was God's faithfulness that they were desiring and longing for, doesn't mean that they couldn't be affected by it and even then begin to live out of it in some way. And so in some profound way, those who live out of this faithfulness or love, we recognize have come into contact with God's grace, that God has sought them out in some way, even if they can't yet name what's happening for them. The prophets tell the story of a people who have chosen to reject God and who then not only destroy themselves, but ultimately they disqualify themselves for the job that God chose them for. God tells his people they can no longer be his priests, not in their current state. See, God made his people to be priests. This is what we hear in the Exodus story. When God draws the people out of Egypt, he brings them to the mountain. He says it is his desire to make them a kingdom of priests. This is what God has been doing for them, that they would reflect his character out into the world. But if his people don't know him, if all they are doing is reflecting all of the values of the world around them, if all they know is the world's ways, then they cannot serve God as God's priests. And so here's what the prophets do. They speak honestly about it. They tell God's people, you look just like your neighbors. Your worship looks just like their worship. The God you talk about sounds just like their gods. You are disqualified from serving in the role that God chose you for. You are incapable of carrying out the duties, the core, in fact, the single duty of that job. But the prophets don't stop there. This isn't permanent disqualification. It's sort of like a timeout. What you need, the prophets say, is to learn faithfulness, to learn love. And the only way to learn these things is to know the Lord your God, who is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. The prophets call the people to return to their God, to take on his character, to be restored as priests in the world. And this is where Jesus steps into the picture for us. As Jesus, a Jewish man, is busy announcing to Israel the good news that God's kingdom is near, the people are busy showing that hundreds of years later, they have not yet learned from the prophets. And so Jesus comes, we're told by the Gospel of John, in grace and in truth. He, as Paul says, is the visible image of the invisible God. And he comes to show what it looks like when a human is radiant with God's steadfast love and faithfulness. This is why the New Testament calls Jesus the great high priest, because he does priestly work. He radiates God's character into the world. And he is, for God's people, the priest that they couldn't be on their own. And yet, it's amazing to think about those who spent years with Jesus, his own disciples, essentially reject the love of God while they scramble for power and for position around him, to exclude children and Samaritans. Jesus' own disciples, they resist the faithfulness of God as they make promises to Jesus, surely I will never abandon you, Jesus, and then abandon him in his final moments. After 3 years with Jesus, none of the disciples are ready to be priests to their God. They might be following Jesus, but they are still very much worshiping old ideas about who God is. And so they do not yet become like Jesus. The passage that Jeannie read for us is challenging because we recognize that it's actually not until Jesus has been raised from the dead and his disciples see him raised that they realize what's happened, that they are able to finally admit that in him they have seen the fullness of God. But one of the things that they recognize as well is that in Jesus, love and faithfulness are no longer just these vague ideas attached to a God who in their hearts is really just like all of their neighbor gods. No. See, in Jesus, God reveals that at the center of his being, he is love and he is faithful. These aren't just words. But in Jesus, they take on flesh, they take on meaning, they take on a depth so that faithfulness looks like God coming to the very people who have broken every single promise they have ever made to him. And amazingly, he doesn't give up on them or break his promise to them or walk away from the promise even though he would be in his right. No. Faithfulness is God carrying out not only his side of the covenant, of the commitment, but even theirs, becoming the priests that they didn't want to be. And then a word like love is no longer just a word, but it has real meaning as it has flesh on it. As we say, love looks like the man with all of the power in the universe who lays it down, letting his own people shed his blood, taking on himself the destruction that they were going to do to themselves. He takes it and he serves them and he sacrifices for them. Jesus shows us what it looks like to truly know God, to know God's faithfulness, to know God's love, and then to demonstrate that faithfulness and love. This was the heart of the prophets, that God's people would return to him, that they would know him, that they would live lives abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, that they would become priests to God. And there's this great moment at the end of the passage that Jeannie read for us. Now that the people know who Jesus is and what he's done, Jesus says, now that they have seen God's love and faithfulness, they are going to be sent out to all nations to announce that God's forgiveness has come and that everyone should return to God. So these people who couldn't be priests on their own have now, through Jesus, been enabled to be priests. Jesus has somehow enacted a transformation, the possibility that men and women could know deeply that they have been forgiven by God. And so that whatever first impression you got of God that made you think that he is scary and that he is to be feared, you need a new first impression. You need to hear Jesus opening your minds, opening your hearts to say, first and foremost, you are forgiven. God is love and God is faithful. Will you receive that truth? Will you receive it and let it change you? We're going to come to the table together so that we can taste so that this knowledge can get in us in a different way. As you eat the bread, as you taste the bread, as you drink the cup, let these tastes remind you of Jesus' words, that you have been forgiven, that God is love, that God is faithful. I want to invite our servers to come.